Was he?
And he had a great friend, and they'd been ordained together. And he was vicar of St. John's, Workington. And this was in Cumberland, you see, my father's parish. And he was a North Irishman, and he was one of the first socialists that I ever met, but he was, in any case, a very active socialist in those days, because so I was born in 95, and I remember when I was about 14, sort of becoming conscious that when Mr. Green came to see my father, there was something worth listening to. You know, I'm amused now to think how I lapped up what he said. Mr. Green was a socialist. He was called himself a Christian socialist.
I see.
And he had this very poor parish in Workington. And, you know, I felt I couldn't help feeling that my father was wrong and that Mr. Green was right. And this feeling, not that I've ever made anything of it properly, but this feeling of being aware of social conditions.
Your father disagreed with...
Yes, and you know, they thoroughly enjoy, he would come for the day, and they would thoroughly enjoy sort of hammer and tongs at each other. And I can remember my father would say, "Oh yes, Bob Green, he's a very nice chap, but he's very misguided. He's got all the wrong ideas." And,
yes, well, I mean, certainly... How did you come to read these reports? I mean, did they come to you naturally?
I just sent for them.
I see, yes.
I knew about them. Somebody produced one copy, and I looked at it and realised this has got the meat in it to some extent, although they probably vary from one area to another, but I got to know a certain number of school medical officers and went and stayed with them. A man in Birmingham, for example, was one, and
they provide you with fuel, in a sense, for your campaign.
Well,
their reports
provided fuel, you know. Mm. And apart from that, they are themselves possibly exaggerating the case a bit. Mm. But they did. I mean, I think it was about that time when the two organisations were becoming fused together, the two sort of movements that had started independently but lived together in friendliness. When they fused, we did send out to a considerable number of medical officers, school medical officers, inquired, you see, about their reports. Their reports tended, by convention, to report on the nutritional condition of children in schools. They would put them down as excellent, normal, subnormal or very subnormal, and they put down the figures, don't you see? Mm. Either the figures or the percentages. In their judgment, this of course would be a subjective judgment to a great extent. So what we did was to send out scores of them, the leading ones, and say, "Would you please say what exactly you mean by normal in a case like this?" And the reply was, "I don't know, practically." Mm. It's just the term that is used. Mm. Mm. Well, medically speaking, you're either normal or you're abnormal, you see. Mm. You can't be normal.
So you want a little standardized.
What they meant was average.
Yes.
Or about as good as we could find.
Or average for the area, or average nationally. I mean, you have to sort that out, didn't you?
And there were many differences here in different parts, according to the peculiar differences in standards in different parts of the country.
Well, that's a good illustration.
Sunday paper was rather a useful vehicle for that kind of thing, or the referee or something, or whatever. Some of these old Sunday papers that have ceased to exist, I think.
Well, what would you do then? Would you write to the editor and say, "I've got a problem, can you help me publicise?"
To the editor? Oh no, I'd send him along the report.
I see, yes.
And, suggest that he might make some use of it, and very often he did.
I see. Yeah.
And got to know one or two of them. Mm.
So you're really rather adept at publicity generally in these organisations.
I try to make myself so, as is possible.
Yeah.
You can do so, do you see? You can achieve quite an ability to sort of get around among people.
What about the BBC?
The BBC...
did you try and impinge on them?
The BBC, yes, I did. And before the war, well, I used to write a lot of school science broadcasts. I suppose before, probably after the war, I think it was. Not much before the war, after, during the war, they were forces broadcasts, and they were almost always on nutritional matters, do you see, and something to do with food, and not necessarily preaching the good gospel of good nutrition, but talking about the subject, getting it a matter of general conversation. And during the war, I did a great deal of lecturing in the armed forces, on subjects of that kind, you see. Not telling them how to eat their food, but just talking about it in general terms. Mm. Or telling anecdotes, or going into the history of the thing. I think that's the way one does it, you see. It's sort of flanking the whole subject around on every side by dealing with it in an as interesting a way as possible. And certainly not preaching.
Did you ever actually lecture at Morley College?
I think I did once, yes.
Because one of the things Eva did was children of pastors.
Yes. Yes. Yes, I was one of the big family, you know, the proud Quiverful. I was the sixth.
Quiverful.
So I didn't get any spoiling.
How many did you have?
12.
Did you really? Well, they think we only had 4. It's quite sufficient.
Well, we were marvellously happy.
We really, yes. Really? See, that is another
meal to be made free, yeah, as part of the whole, well, she liked to have led towards that, as part of the whole structure of school life, as part of the training in school life, of social training, says Duell. After all, the meal is the place where you learn social manners and social relations with other people. I hoped that kind of thing might have happened a bit more.
So your objective wasn't just to deal with poverty or malnutrition?
Oh, certainly not. No, it was originally, of course, in great extent, because after the war I had during the war done a certain amount of it, but I finally produced a thing I call the Social History of the School Meal Service, and then cut it down to size and got it published by National Council of Social Service. And that was fairly comfortably distributed. I don't think I got much out of one of the lively parts of the teaching profession. Association of the Teachers of Domestic Subjects.
I see.
Domestic Science, I feel what it's called. I get there monthly.
Yes.
Journal coming along called Housecraft.
Yes.
Which I consider to be one of the most lively, as I say, of these kind of journals. There's a lot of information in it. It's often very interesting, lively articles.
Mm.
And, because they see the children close up, after all, under their most natural conditions. Mm. And we endeavoured to, I remember, at the end of the war, to get the teaching of domestic subjects universalised for boys and girls alike, with no distinction made, and only in the basic foundation work, the rudiments of it.
What's a domestic subject?
Cooking, choice of foods, budgeting, dealing with clothes, and general domestic subjects, so far as they can expand them.
I see, because Eva argues for that.
Like odd repair jobs and things like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sure that hasn't gone for...
Little textbooks on cooking, of course, cookery. They said, we really want something on that links up cookery with, well, the elements of nutrition. So we produced a thing called Planning Meals, which ran quite well for some time. I don't know how it's running now.
What was it, a periodical?
No, it was a booklet.
Oh, yes.
First of all, it was published by a publisher, I think, called Planning Meals, by your servant, and somebody else. I forget now what her name was. We linked it together, and I think I wrote most of it. It was intended to be a kind of little reading book for younger children, you know, when they first of all started this kind of thing. And so it was therefore kept pretty simple, with a lot of amusing illustrations in it, or what we hoped were amusing illustrations. Anyhow, it went really well for a few years.
So you really have it. Yes, you said your wife was saying your father came from Bradford.
Yes, well, that's right. Well, I was born in Bradford, 1906, and the next thing I knew, we were in Preston. Apparently, we came 1907. Why, I don't know. I've heard Mother say that Dad made Bradford too hot for himself. He was a carpenter by trade, and what he went on, I know that he did strive to improve conditions, because as it says in the book, he lost jobs, more than one job, through trying to better them. And what had happened, I don't know, but I think as a youngster, he had a pretty rough time of it. There was a big family of them, and when I remember Grandad, they were comfortably off. But of course, a number of the family were working. But I heard Dad say that he hadn't an overcoat in which to go to school in winter. And he used to put a sack over his shoulders to keep the rain off, and the kids used to rag him. But he was always a pretty good scholar, especially at figures. And apparently the last lesson of the morning must have been arithmetic and so on, and the teacher let those out first who had finished their work, you see. And he said he used to hurry his work and get out so the kids wouldn't rag him. Now that's about the only thing I know of his boyhood, except, as I said, he came to Preston in must have been the, because I was not quite 2 years old when they came. Now, he followed the same craft, but of course I don't know much about that then, but Mary was born in 1908.
Mm. Yes.
She was born 1908, yeah. And Dad was in and out of work, I fancy. We never really went short of anything, but it was always a struggle, you see. And I think Mother, as far as I know, in her young days, she was in service. I know a grandma, that was her mother, lived in Wakefield. I only remember seeing her once, and I never saw her father. Her father must have died when she was young. Anyway, to try to remember as far back as I can, it isn't very, very far, really, except that up to the war, Dad was always keen on politics, and he was fond of going out into company, but from what I can gather, I don't think Mother was. She was quite happy to stay at home with the kids. And up to the war, there was myself, there was Mary, with about 2 years between each one, then there was Leonard, and then there was Alf. Now, Alf must have been a baby when the war broke out. Dad was a member of the ILP, the Independent Labour Party, and he's pretty well in with that. And then he came out of work. I think that was the one that's referred to in there. He was working at Cartmel's. They were joiners and builders, and he was in charge of the undertaking. Well, he was the undertaker. I wouldn't say he was in any high position, but he did coffin making. And he suddenly got the sack, and he'd been told that there's nothing wrong, found nothing wrong with his work. In fact, I believe they gave him a written testimonial, but he was making the men dissatisfied. And really, what it was over, as far as I can gather, there was a scheme got going eventually, whereby all the workers paid tuppence a week towards the Royal Infirmary, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Penny.
One penny a week, was it? Anyway, it was either tuppence or a penny a week. I think it did go up to tuppence eventually.
But at that time, it was
a penny a week. And the employers and some of the workpeople resented this thing. And this was one of the reasons, apart from others, he used to, if he found anybody being ill-treated, browbeaten, he'd always take up their case. In fact, we honestly, after the family talked it over years afterwards, if he'd worked as hard for his home as he did for other people, he'd have been better off anyway financially, because he lost lots of jobs. And I can remember one case where there was a nurse Bolton. She was what they called the district nurse in those days, and I don't know how the thing was run, but it was run by some sort of a committee, and there was a solicitor, a big man in Preston, who was more or less in charge. And she'd done something, or hadn't done something, what it was I don't know, but she was thrown off. She was thrown out of this job, actually. and Dad took up her case. And I can remember, you won't know it, but the black, if you'd come off at the other round, at the other junction,
yes.
You'd come up past the cemetery, and there's a big one, it's a roundabout now. But in those days, there was just the electric cars running. And I remember he borrowed a lorry, a horse-drawn lorry, and he got all the neighbourhood round, and he had this meeting, and he got this nurse reinstated. Well, he was quite pleased over that, but this is where I'll show you, it comes back and
it reflects on the family eventually.
Apparently, the district where we lived, this was near the cemetery, there was somebody, a John Farrington, had died and left some money. They called it John Farrington's Charity, and this money was for students and apprentices, you know, to help them buy books and tools and things. Well, when I started work, I left school at 13 and a half, and I started work as an apprentice joiner eventually, after a bit of struggle with my dad. Dad said, oh, we'll see if we can get some of this grant. And apparently it was the same solicitor who Dad had more or less defeated over this nurse business who dealt with this. And when my dad went to see him about it, oh, he said, no, this is where I left ye, and he says, I told you. No. And that was the end of it. And we could really, I mean, my
you
sister...
You could have done with it, really.
My sister, were, she won a scholarship to the girls' high school, and she could have had something, but anyway, she didn't. Anyway, this is just, that's more or
so
less jumping
ahead. So it hit the family in a way.
It hit the family in that way. See, and it often happened like that. Mm-hmm. Well, Dad joined the army. I think it was the second year of the war, or the first year of the war. It was early on, anyway. He came out of work.
He volunteered,
and,
did he?
And he, oh, yes, he volunteered. And really, he surprised a lot of people. I mean, at that time, the Socialist Party weren't sympathetic towards the war. I mean, there's a lot of people, and I think I'm a little bit that way. Whose war is it? Who are we fighting for?
Yeah.
But Dad went off, and some of his friends told him, I'm rather surprised that you were Eden being in a hurry to join the army. But I think at the time, I think he really wanted a bit of adventure, and he wanted to get away from
but
things.
But I think he was unemployed too, wasn't
he? Well, he was unemployed, yes, but he'd been unemployed before.
That had some bearing on it.
It had, that's what made him go, actually. He went to the employment office, to the recruitment office, and he met a fellow named Wilding, and they were together right throughout the war. They were both carpenters, but they didn't know each other until the war started.
He's a private soldier in the war.
He went in, yes, he joined up in the Army Service Corps, which was later changed to the Army Ordnance Corps. He was supposed to follow his own craft.
I see.
Anyway, to show you what sort of a chap he was, he joined up and he wanted to get out to France. I suppose he was fairly young in those days. And he had to do a test. And somebody had pinched his job, he reckons. Each man had to make some sort of a joint. And he said that there was a lot of jiggery-pokery going on because somebody had swapped the work. But anyway, when they came to the final crunch as to whether they'd passed or failed, his dad had some sort of a joint to make, and I don't know whether you know. Do you know what a tenon saw is?
Yes.
The one
with
the brass back.
Yes, I know.
Well, the one that he got, they were tools that were army tools anyway, and he said it was in shocking condition. He told me this himself. The bottom of the saw, the blade, instead of being straight, it was bent. Well, he said to the fellow in charge of the test, wasn't a craftsman, it was somebody just overlooking him. And he said, can I straighten this saw? Well, he said, if you can straighten it, good luck. Well, if you can straighten the saw by tapping the back, either if you want it to come up at the ends, you tap it in the middle, you tap it at the end if you want it to go down. And he just happened to hit it in the right place and the saw went straight. And the chap said, oh, well, you were through already. Anyway, they get in this ordnance corps and they get the billeted at Park Royal Camp London. And they were given mounted drill. What do they call it? Instead of being infantry, they were on horseback.
Oh, yes, yes.
I don't know what they...
Well, that's infantry, is horseback.
Cavalry is on foot.
Cavalry, that's right.
Because a lot of the guns and the wagons were pulled by horses in the First World War.
Yeah.
And they were standing guard over horses, grooming them and, taking this mounted drill. And the chaps in this, whatever it was, a platoon, I think it was that he was in, they objected and they complained, but nothing happened. And they were said they fed up, they'd come in to follow the craft, not to look after horses. And so they got together and they said, next time we go on parade and they start giving us orders for mounted work, we'll not do it, we'll refuse. So I think Dad was one of the instigators of this. Anyway, they went on duty apparently and on parade, and they, wherever it was, the, what do they call
Sergeant
them,
Major.
Sergeant Major, yeah. I think it was, started giving them orders and they refused to move. So this bloke must have been wise and he said, well, surely you've got a spokesman. Step forward. And my dad stepped forward, and as he did, the rest of the line came up with him. But it was too late, they'd seen him. So he went to see the bloke in charge, whoever he was, and he said, well, I'm very sympathetic. He said, and I can see that this is wrong and it's never been intended. But he said, you know, I can't let you get away with it. So he got 10 days confined to barracks. But anyway, after that, they were moved, and eventually they went out to France, and he was out there, and must have been about 3 years, I should think. He was never, I don't think he was ever actually in the fighting line. He never told us much about it, but they were with the ordnance workshops. And he came home quicker than we expected. When the peace was signed, we got a telegram to say that he was passing through Preston on his way up to Scotland, where they expect to be demobbed. But anyway, we went to meet the train as it stopped in Preston, and he got off and came home. Well, he seemed a changed man. He was still interested in politics, but he didn't get off as much as he used to do. He was a big cyclist. He belonged to the Clarion Cycle Club, and he often went up to political meetings, but he calmed down. And actually, during the war, I started with a schoolboy allotment. And when he came home, he got interested in this, and as the war finished, the boys gave them up, and they were small allotments, and they put them together and made them into bigger ones. And he came and he quite interested, and we worked together. He took a big interest in gardening. And then he was working for the Ribble Navigation on the docks.
Still carpentry, yes.
Mm-hmm. He's, from what I can gather, what I remember of him, he was an extremely good carpenter, but nowadays he would be classed a bit slow, you see. Mm. I mean, now it's a question to get the work done and get off, you see. Anyway, he did take an interest in politics, and I can remember, I was apprentice joiner then. I left school at 13 and a half, and Dad didn't want me to be a joiner.
Why not, actually?
Well, I don't know.
He thought if you could get a job, he used to call it a white-collar job.
That's right.
You were made. He didn't want him to work with his hands.
No.
A lot of working people were like that.
Oh, yes.
Get the children out.
Yes, he says, if you want to take your jacket off, lad, you'll never put it on again. That was his argument. And I think to some extent I agree with him. But anyway, I stayed on. I could have left at 13. I stayed on 6 months. And I think I was getting a bit restless, wanted to leave. And I had to have a job, apparently, before I could leave. And I got a job as an errand boy with a baby linen shop. And I was there 6 months. And then I passed... in the meantime, the headmaster, he thought that I would be better in clerical work. In fact, I'd gone to night school, taking a technical course there. And I passed the first year. And the second year when I went... in the meantime... The headmaster got me a job in the corporation offices, market offices here, see. And I didn't want it, but anyway, I went, and I was there about 18 months, and I think as a kid, it was the most worrying time of my life. I couldn't see any future for it, though, in a way, perhaps I was silly, because all the lads who'd worked in this post where I was, they ended up in the town hall. Man, you're just as clerks.
Yes.
But yeah. I didn't like office work at all. And they had a joiner's shop behind where they repaired the market stalls. And every time the boss wanted me, I was in there. Till eventually, and I'd pestered me dad, I wanted to be a joiner. I was turned 16 then. And the market superintendent, who was my boss, sent for dad and said he didn't think it was any use. I was never interested in this job. He says, every time I want him, he's got to go and wash his hands before he can come and do what I want. So he said, I think you'd better get him a job. Anyway, I went to a firm and I served. I'm talking about myself now. Anyway, I was there. I served my apprenticeship up to 21 as a joiner, you see. Well, during this time, he just carried on in a very, very quiet way. And... When I was 17, the youngest lad was born. That was Ron. He lives not far from here. And then, I was working then as a carpenter. Well, when did Dad's health start to fail, though?
It was before after I met you in 1926, mm-hmm. and it would be a year. He didn't look a well man when I met him then. Mm. He was failing. And
what was wrong with his health?
TB.
Actually? Oh, was it really?
TB.
It was TB, yes. They couldn't do anything for them in those days. I mean,
do you know, you missed an incident out that was quite yes. interesting, and it was when you said your father said there was something for you on this, they were bringing back from the army, and it was
that's right. No. Well, I'd thought about it, but yes, Dad, when he came home, we thought he was going to be demobbed, yeah. and he came straight home from the station. In fact, I was on, when my mother got the telegram, I was on the allotment. And I had a little truck that I used to carry stuff in, a box, soap box, and it had only one wheel, one that come off. And she sent, I think it was Leonard, to tell me, it's a come home, we're to go and meet your dad at the station. Well, of course, me, I'm still like it, aren't I? Everything had to be just so. I tied it up and I came down the side. It was a mile and a half to the allotment. And mother came to meet me. Come on, we're to be at the station. Leave the truck, ship it in the hedge. But no, I wouldn't. Anyway, we met Dad. Dad came home and he said, I can remember telling Mother, I'm sorry that I've had to leave that. The wagons, they were all together apparently. He said, I thought we'd have been staying with these wagons and going up to Scotland, because he said, I've got some tools planted in there and there's some tins of bully beef. He says, and if they're going to Scotland, they'll pass our house. We live just by the motorway, really. And he said, I was going to drop them off as we passed. And he described these wagons, and he'd written on in red, white and blue chalk, first stop Blighty, you know, and one or two things like this. Well, all time went on, perhaps a week or so, a couple of weeks. I was playing down by the river, which is about a mile away from where we lived. It's the top of the valley. It falls down to where the motorway crosses the river. And we were coming home, two or three lads of mine, and we said, these wagons coming up the hill, and I mean, in those days, they couldn't go very fast, especially uphill. And I noticed these things, first stop Blighty, so I ran home like the dickens, brought my dad out, and he stood at the front door, and almost with tears in his eyes, watching these things go past. He said, there's stuff in there that I wanted. So, I mean, that was the episode that you remember.
That was the one.
But it was a coincidence, yes. Really.
Was he always a Labour voter?
Yes, a very strong... in fact, if he'd lived to be nowadays, they'd have classed him as a communist. He was considered an extreme.
He was very left, wasn't he?
He was very, very left indeed. I mean, that was our way. He got to join the women's suffrage movement.
Well, that's what I wanted to lead on to, in a way. I mean, he supports anyone who's against...
It was always the bottom dog.
Yeah.
And that was, what were you going to say, dear?
What they call the ruling class, what do we call it? The
capitalist?
No. Never mind,
it'll come to you.
In the government, you mean? Or?
Not government, no.
Establishment.
Establishment.
It was always against the establishment.
Was he? Yes.
Oh,
mm.
Yes.
Locally and nationally, in every way.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Well, we're the same, aren't we?
I think we are.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Touched that way. Yes. I don't want to interrupt your there's a little bit incidents to explain what things were like in those days. Here's a document. I don't think you'll see it again. Not many of them. Before I could leave school, I had to get this document, and that showed the extent of my education.
Really? Yes.
I'm never been ill.
He was really against anybody in authority.
It was against, not necessarily in authority, it was against the, what is the word? Against the eye, but I know it was because the inequality of conditions in those days, you see.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know whether you've read that book, The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You know it. Well, that was typical, wasn't it? I mean, it was even like that before the war, in our own case, you see. When we were married in 1929, my wife and I, and We'd been married, we lived in rooms for about 9 months, wasn't it? And we got a little cottage in Alexander Street. Mm-hmm. And I asked the boss, could I have a day off, or half a day, I forget which, to move. I mean, we hadn't much furniture, to move from this rooms to where we were going. And he said, oh yes, that would be all right. But and it was only a smallish firm. And at that time, I was working, doing some repairs in a house. And he'd asked me to work a little bit of overtime each night. And perhaps an hour and a half to get the job done. Well, this particular night, I'd got the key of the cottage, and I wanted to go in and get something ready for when they brought the furniture in. So I didn't work. Anyway, I'd just got home, I just had my tea, and knock at the door, and the boss's son arrived. He says, my father says, if you want Friday off for moving, you've got to go back and work tonight. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, nowadays, what they say, get stuffed, and they'd have everybody out, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
But I had it to do. I mean, that was that was 1929, wasn't it?
30. We were 29.
Oh, it was 1930.
But tell me about your father's relationship with your mother, because was he a feminist in his personal life? Do you see what I mean? I mean, he's a feminist because he champions people politically underprivileged, yes. Sort of thing. But does that carry into the way he behaved in the house?
Well, I think it did really. He let mother have a lot of her own way, didn't he? And she had a very, for a working class woman, I think she had a pretty sheltered life. But I don't know really that it
did
was...
Did he help in the house? I mean, did he do things more than other men did?
No, I wouldn't say he did, no. I mean, no. Not as regards housekeeping. No, I always got the impression that Mother was glad for him to go out and leave her with the kids. You see, even when we got on a bit older and we had little parties and brought friends in, she would say, oh, well, but you go out, you know, you have somewhere to go. And she'd join in like a kid along with the rest of us. But he was always fairly good this way. He made things for the house as much as he could afford, and he kept as comfortable as he could. And he did. There was never any real upset between the two. My mother and dad. I mean, the only time that they fell out was over money matters. Mm. I mean, mother would say she'd had a struggle to make ends meet this week, and he'd say, "Well, let's sit down and talk about it." And she'd end up by saying, oh, well, if you think you can manage better than me, you spend the money. So poor old Dad was defeated. And of course, I got the impression as a kid then that Dad was a bit of an ogre at times. And I was always sorry for my mum. But I realised since that I think she led him a bit of a dance in some respects.
She was a suffragette as well.
She was a suffragette, yes. And I was surprised because... She wasn't a belligerent type,
was
she?
Not a militant type, no.
I think that she'd been influenced mainly by Dad and the people that he came in contact with because of his interest, in the first place, of his interest in the suffrage movement. Mm. So that, and then I suppose he encouraged her to do it, but I can't remember where he was during these events.
I think he got involved with the suffragettes. I think it was because he was involved with the labour movement.
Yes,
and Mrs. Rigby got in touch with him. Wasn't she a labour supporter?
Yeah.
And I think they got in touch that way.
He was in Preston, was he, when this was all happening?
All this happened in Preston. Mm. We stayed in... Well, they stayed in Preston for the rest of his life. Yeah. I mean, in the book it mentions about him going to Marylaw Cottage. Well, it gives the impression that we took that place over.
No, it didn't.
Which we didn't. What happened when when Dr. Rigby died, Mrs. Rigby's husband, he'd enjoyed this cottage along with her, and she didn't know what to do. And she said, well, I think I'll keep it as a memorial to my husband. Well, who could she put in it? Well, I don't know how it came about, but we ended up there. I don't think Mother ever wanted to go. And I went because, it's very exciting and all the rest of it. I was 20, wasn't I?
I was
20. It was after you met me.
Yes, because we were.
And we moved there. And it was hard work for Mother. And there was a lot of land. And Dad was still following his craft as a carpenter. He was working for Ribble Navigation. And there was some talk, I don't know who'd started it, but some talk that it would be a good idea if he gave up his work and developed this as a small holding. Well, I think in a half-hearted way, I was quoting then, And
you weren't
half-hearted, could you? No, I was in a half-hearted way. I supported him, you see. But he wouldn't. Dad was always on the timid side. We'd have had to borrow some money, which he would have thought was something terrible. He wouldn't have anything on hire purchase or anything like that. And as regards mortgaging a house, when we were married, we bought this little cottage. It cost us £400. And he came down and had a look at it. And he said to you, didn't he, "What's our Bert think about bringing you here?" He said, "You've got a millstone round your neck for 25 years. It was 20 years, actually, wasn't it?" So, I mean, that was the type of fellow he was. He couldn't...
Very respectable type, was he?
Oh, yeah.